This is how it goes.
You can
take the stage badge out of the booth. You cannot take the booth out of the stage badge.
Come on,
thank
sir.
You. You better preach. I like that. You better preach that. Sounds good. You better preach that. See, you know how us stage managers roll.
Okay, everybody, stand by.
Welcome to Artistry Avenue, a Reclaiming Our Time production podcast where we examine the intersection between theater and social issues. This is Natasha A. Jackson, the Executive Director of Reclaiming Our Time Productions.
And I am J. Marjorie Henderson. I am the Artistic Director for Reclaiming Our Time Productions. And today we have a special guest with us. Very, very excited to have. Playwright, educator, all around actor, just multi-hyphenate. Incredible talent. Mr. Ian Finley is in the podcast room today. Can we give him a round of applause? Do we have an applause thing? We ain't got that yet. Let's applaud ourselves. Right. There we go. Ian Finley is here, y'all.
Great to be here.
He is the writer and of Native, so we'll definitely get into that, which is going to be our first production in September. But we definitely want to get to know Ian himself.
Yes.
For sure.
Right. Most definitely. Most definitely. So, Ian, thank you for being here today.
Yeah, it's a joy. It's a fantastic to come out and play with you guys.
Oh, awesome. Awesome.
Watch out. It was a playground. I like that. Right. The kid in me wants to... Okay, never mind. Let me focus.
All art is play, right? I mean, there we go. It really comes down to it. It's called a play for a reason.
Exactly. Exactly. It is called a play for a reason. So... You wrote Native, right? How did that even start?
Okay, so
How did that come about?
I'm going to tell you the whole full story. It's not too long because it's quite cool. Over 10 years ago, 11, 12 years ago, I was asked by Dana Cohen, who teaches playwriting and screenwriting at Chapel Hill, to write one of a series of short plays about a painting in the Ackland Museum of Art. It's part of a series called Activated Art. And he'd asked me to do it. And that was just like, pick a painting, write a play about it. And it's okay, this seems very random, but kind of fun. So I did that. And then he paired us up with different directors. And the director he paired me up with was Serene Ebhart, who I'd never worked with before. I'd seen her on stage. She's an incredible actress. But I'd never worked with her. And we got along like a house on fire. That short play is one of the best things I've ever written. And her directing is just fearless and wonderful. And getting to know each other, then we finished that project. And then a couple weeks later, she calls me and says, hey, we've been thinking about Paul Green and Richard Wright. We'd like to talk to you about them. I said, okay, great, fantastic. And then I went home and I Googled Paul Green and Richard Wright.
Right, right.
Because these are two names that were way back in the back of my head. But I had no idea. I had no idea what they did together, right? They were two entirely different parts. So I read up about Native Son and the adaptation, and I met with David Zimbrunnen and Serena, and they said, you know, we've been looking at this story, the conflict between these two men, and their attempts to create something, and the trouble that happens when you attempt to create something that speaks to the world. And we've been thinking about trying to put that on stage for a long time, and we think you're the writer to do that. And so that's how the process started.
Wow,
That's incredible.
Yeah, I did not know. Yeah. To be honest with you.
So, because of the genetic makeup of who you are, you're a white guy.
Yeah.
How did you find the voice that Richard has in this piece?
I have been dying.
to ask you that question.
I think
this is why ultimately they asked me to write this. Is because prior to this, and even during this, I have written when I was at Burning Coal Theatre Company for 8 years. I was their resident playwright, and we did a lot of historical pieces. And so my training at NYU is in docudrama. That is taking existing documents, existing sources, usually primary sources, and trying to pull a narrative out of them while keeping as much of the original material as possible. This is something that Moises Kaufman started with the Three Trials of Oscar Wilde, Gross Indecency, with the Laramie Project, taking real people's real words and using them to create something on stage. And so that was my training at NYU, and that's what I did. Using historical documents at Burning Coal. And that's why I think they said, you're the right person to create Richard Wright and Paul Green on stage because you have the tools to go into what they wrote and put that on stage. And so that was the whole goal. It was not to try to create Richard Wright's voice, but to go through his, thank God, his copious amount of writing and pull that into it. And so that was, I think, what my goal was not to try to generate a character, which would have been, you know, inaccurate,
right? Yeah.
But rather to try to get their voices and then their ideas. My goal was never to put anything on the page that wasn't an idea that they had expressed, ideally the way they expressed it. And so I spent a year reading everything. Mm-hmm. And luckily we have, from Richard Wright, we have Black Boy, we have his various essays on politics in America. We have the seminal piece, How Bigger Was Born, mm-hmm. which is his foreword to Native Son that really gets into his thought processes. And then on the other hand, we have A Southern Life, which is the collection by Lawrence of Avery of Paul Green's letters, and his letters specifically from 1941 through 1945 when he's producing this, when he's writing mm-hmm. this. So we have his side of the conversation, plus some other documents in there. Interview that Green did with Rhoda Wynn at the North Carolina collection at Chapel Hill was huge. So I spent a year just soaking in the voices of these two characters and soaking in their ideas. And then I started trying to make it into something that would actually work on stage while maintaining as much of their own voice. So the goal here was not to create a character, but to try to put words and ideas that they had already expressed on stage and then to shape it into something that would work in terms of dramatic structure. So does that answer the question?
It really is, because when I think about the first time I seen Native before I even started mm-hmm. stage managing it, you could not tell me that a white male wrote that play, because there were some lines in there that just makes you want to stand on your feet, talk back to the stage. Like, yes, this is what we deal with. Mm-hmm. This is. And so when I remember, I was like, Ian Finley, that don't sound. That don't sound like one of us. I was like, okay, maybe. Because every now and again, we get some names. Mm. But then I was like, oh, no, he's not one of us. But somehow he captured Richard Wright in a way that just exemplified the struggle that Black men experienced then. And then the other thing, I was just like, why is this piece so relevant mm-hmm. now, even though it's supposed to be from then?
Mm-hmm. Which is the gift and the curse of it, that mm-hmm. we're still having these conversations and they're. I don't know if we've progressed as far as we think we have a lot of times. Mm-hmm. And I think, and I know too, being that I'm in the show, that this isn't the version that we do now isn't mm-hmm. the original version. So how did you go about the revisions?
That was, thank God for all of that, because the challenge is when you're working with documents, when you're working with the actual things people said, that they weren't writing those pieces to be on stage, right? Mm-hmm. They weren't mm-hmm. writing those in conversation. They were, in Richard Wright's case, you know, these are very dense, serious essays and sure. novels and his autobiography. And trying to pull that and restructure it as a play is hard. And you, as an actor, you know how dense these words are,
for sure.
right?
Yeah,
to be able to try to memorize them, to try to make them active in the way that lines in a play have to be active. And so this play went through, I think this is draft 17, over the course of 4 years, basically being just revised and revised and revised and revised, and which is good. That's how I write. I'm a horrible writer. I'm an okay reviser.
We're not going to let you
say
that.
No.
Okay.
The second part is the important part, is that my first drafts are always crap, and they should be. First drafts need to be bad if they're ever going to get good. I am at least a dedicated reviser. And through revision, all art comes through revision. And if you just keep chipping away at it, you know, the block of marble, which is just stone, can become something that looks like something else. But it has to do with coming back to it and coming back to it, coming back to it. So I'm a huge fan of the revision process. And that's what we did with Native. We kept coming back. A big part of that was Deep Dish, a wonderful theater company, a true loss to our community that is no longer around. And they had tremendous support for new plays and gave us the tremendous gift of a reading in front of an audience and then had like 3 days to revise the script and then another in front of an audience. So three in front of an audience where we could get feedback.
Oh, wow.
And then enough time. And I stayed up pretty much 24 hours in between each of those those readings, revising the script, because the blessing and the curse of being in front of an audience is the good thing is it makes all the problems very clear. And the bad thing is it makes all the problems very clear.
Right. Yeah.
And so it's like, okay, I know what's broken. I just need to go fix it now. And so I would go home. I would come back with the script and we would put it in front of the audience again, script in hand. And those problems would be fixed. Thank God. Oh my God, it reveals all the other problems. And so this, it was such a blessing to get through that. And it was a very, very different play by the end of that process.
So not to harp on this, but I have to ask, did you get feedback from a person of color or multiple people of color? Because you have to see this play to really understand.
Yeah.
You really have to.
Yeah.
But did you get any type of feedback or direction or guidance?
We had in those readings, we had a couple of people. I'm forgetting his name. Who originally read for Richard Wright, who was involved at Chapel Hill, one of the professors there. And then we had several of his Black co-professors there at Chapel Hill who came in and worked with us and gave us feedback throughout that process. Every one of those three, we had some there, and which was good because not only were they necessary Black voices, but they were used to dealing with documents. They were all academics, so they were able to say, okay, here is this idea. Look at this piece, right? Look at this piece of Wright specifically. And to be able to not only say what ideas needed to be developed, but also the sources that we could go to find how to develop those. Because the whole point of the piece was to stay away from what I intuit as a human being. And get to what these specific people put on paper so that there was no guessing about ideas, that it all could be coming from that. So one of the things I really like is that the word playwright is spelled W-R-I-G-H-T, like a cartwright or a wheelwright, and it speaks to the idea that this is not supposed to be an art in some sort of airy, fairy, intangible way. It's meant to be a craft. It's meant to be something that you take a set of tools and a set of materials and you a set of plans and you build something that will be lasting out of them. And great craftsmanship is art, right? That's all that art is. It is skill and it is craftsmanship that has been elevated through the addition of love, right? That's what I think art is, at least. And in this case, the raw material I was working with were documents, right? Mm-hmm. They're the things they actually said, the ideas they actually had, and being able to be then supplied with more of those, it increased the raw material I was able to build out of.
I got a question. As loud as I am, I don't need to move the mic closer, but I will. And you may have said it. Yeah. I was trying to make sure everything was good in the beginning. What made you decide to do docu-series as opposed to doing regular plays?
So that goes way, way back. So my undergrad work was at the University of Utah in the actor training program there, which is a very, very fine program. And there I was introduced through my movement teacher, a guy named Jerry Garter. Love Jerry. Jerry is fantastic. He was, I think, 52 years old at the time. Black man who grew up in the Bronx, was in a street gang, and then he decided in his early 20s, you know what? This life isn't for me. He went to Asia to study martial arts and then became this very famous, like, martial arts, like, stand-in stunt double trainer. And then he's like, okay, I'm done with that. And he came back to Utah, of all places, and taught movement and Buto and, like, ran a martial arts studio there. Anyway, one of the most amazing human beings in the event. And he introduced me to this guy named Augusto Boal. And Augusto Boal was a Colombian theater maker and playwright, and he wrote a series of books. The seminal one is The Theater of the Oppressed, and the idea of How is theater used not only to enrich audiences and implicitly enrich white rich audiences, but rather how can theater be used to overthrow oppression? And he wrote about that in the 70s and did an enormous work with that. So it's Theater of the Oppressed and Games for Actors and Non-Actors. He introduced me to those books. And I read those and it's like, oh, well, this is what I'm supposed to be doing, right? This is the point. This is why it is worthwhile to be involved in the theater, not just to make pretty and moving and beautiful things, but to change the world. Because what else is the point, yes, right? And the technique that Bowal speaks of in Theater of the Oppressed is this idea of docudrama. This idea of, because if you're making things up, people in power can attack that, right? Oh, there's just a playwright. Mm. There's just that, making things up, right? The world isn't really like that. It's all in his head. Whereas if you have documents, right? Documents are the unassailable thing. Those are the things that, you know, this is, unfortunately, we live in a world now where even when something is documented, right, even when there is questioned evidence, mm-hmm, right, it's talked again. And that just makes me crazy. it's like my whole training is, if there's the evidence, the documents are the foundation. And once you get to the foundation, it is unarguable, right? And now we live in a world where even that is being challenged by people who have come up against the evidence and don't want the evidence to, mm-hmm, be there. So they'll just pretend that it's not. And it's like dealing with a 3-year-old. Anyway, not getting into that. but that was Bowal's idea, right? Mm-hmm. Is if you have a foundation that is documented, then you can build a structure that is very powerful, and using that, then you can change society.
I got one more if I'm allowed. By the way, I am the tech engineer for Reclaiming Our Time. My name is Hieronymus Lechtenstein.
Okay, that is not your name.
My name is Juan Isler. We'll move on.
I don't even know what to say.
My other question, and this is just from listening to you talk, you were mentioning that the first draft or the first, and then the first time it's seen by people,
yeah,
that the whole purpose of that is so that you can go back and make revisions.
Yeah.
So even plays that are already the fiction plays, mm-hmm, and
yeah,
the Sondheims, yeah, and stuff like what we did a few months ago, do you think that audiences should come, mm-hmm, sooner than the day before so that, mm-hmm, the actors can see?
So it, well, yes. So, the theater, I love theater because it's a living process. It's different, mm-hmm, than a statue. Or it's maybe more accurately, it's different than a novel, right? A novel is a private conversation between the author and the audience. It's very intimate in that way. It's direct. My ideas into these words, into your eyes, right? Maybe there's an editor in the way. But, and that's lovely and that's wonderful. It's not something I'm interested in. What I'm interested in is this collaboration, because a play is the opposite of intimate, right? It is not a direct conversation from me, the playwright, into you, the audience member. It is a conversation between me, the playwright, mm-hmm, to a director and a production, yes, team and a bunch of other actors and these incredible artists, and we come together. And then that's not even direct, right? Then that is put in front of an audience, and then they have their own interaction, which is also with the other people in the audience, which is the rest of their day, which is the set. So you have this multifarious thing coming together, and it can become more than the sum of its parts. It can become the opposite, right? You can have a great play that is ruined by a bad production. We've all seen those sort of things, but we can also have...
Yes, we have.
No comment.
A great play that becomes so much greater, not just bigger, but wider because of how it is done. I think that the great example of this, right, is Hamilton, right? Because that is, it's a work of genius. I love that music. I love that play and that story, but the casting is the thing that makes it work. Right. It is Renée Elise Goldsberry, right? It is her, it is not just Angelica, it is her as Angelica, yeah, that makes that moment immortal. Right. It is that sort of thing. So you get this building. That's why I love playwriting, is people say, oh, I love your script. And what they really mean is, I love this genius actor and this genius director and what they've done with your script. But I get to say as a playwright, oh, yes, thank you for loving my script. I get to steal the genius of everyone else in the room. All of which to say is, going back to the actual question of, you know, when should the audience come in there? Because it is a living thing. The play doesn't exist until all of those components, including the audience, is there. Now, the problem is, because it is this big multifarious thing. The audience shows up. There's often only so much that can be done when the audience comes in and we realize, oh, this moment, which is supposed to be funny, isn't getting any laughs. Like, what can we do? This is why, Sondheim himself, he would always try his shows out of town, right? They'd open at the paper mill and then there'd be weeks of revisions before coming back in and seeing that sort of thing. Same thing, I remember the musical Ragtime, which we did years ago, it tried out in California, actually. And that's where I saw it. I was in high school at the time and tried out there. And no one knew it was in previews, right? So we had no idea what this show was, Ragtime. And then we saw it. It's like, oh, my God, this is incredible. This is mind-blowing. And then, of course, it goes on to Broadway, and that's the show we all know. But it was a very different show in California. And you have to put something in front of an audience to see what is working, what isn't working, because it's not just what's on the page. It's not what's in the rehearsal room. It is a communication, a conversation between the audience. Without the audience, you can't guess it. You can try. Producers and directors and playwrights try to guess, but until you actually have that audience there, you never know, right?
Yeah, I definitely agree. I always say that plays are meant to be read aloud. They're meant to be, because when you just read it by yourself, it's just like, you can't hear the voices of the, you can make up your own voices. Yeah. And if you hear voices, you know, it's okay.
That's a okay. Whole different topic.
You know, I mean, there's therapy if you need to, you know, that's a thing. But I'm joking, but not.
Yeah.
But yeah, so plays are meant to be read aloud. It's supposed to be a communal thing. Mm-hmm. So when you go to a show or in a show that you've written and you hear those responses, that's the ultimate goal, right? Because I know I'll go to a show and you're going to hear me respond. Yes. And my mom is the same way. And it's like some people are opposed to that. But so as a playwright, do you prefer to hear those responses?
It's necessary. It's like, what is the, you might as well have written a book before. And there are, in the 1800s, there was this whole genre of plays called chamber plays, which were plays that were meant to be read. Great. Fantastic. That's an interesting form of art. But that's not all plays. That's not what plays as we understand them are meant to be, which is this conversation, this communication. You always know if I'm in the audience because I have the most machine gun laugh in the world. And I'm not, you know this, you've heard this. I'm not ashamed of that because it's like, if what am I here for if not to engage with the play? And if I'm engaged with the play, then there's going to be a response to that. But the best moments, it was so perfect. It was so perfect. I saw Denzel Washington and the incomparable Viola Davis do Fences on Broadway. And it tells you just how good she is, because when she's on stage, no one was paying any attention to Denzel Washington. It takes someone to be that magnetic on stage. Yeah. Her Rose was just, it was like nothing else. And there's this moment where she has just berated Troy's character and slam the door. It's this wonderful moment. And then from up in the balcony behind me, I hear this voice crawl, if you don't want him, I'll take him. And it's like, and it was perfect. And it's like, and that's the moment. And August Wilson in his grave was happy at that moment because that is the appropriate response to those moments on stage. It's a real thing. It's not a, this is the thing. I love film. I love cinema, but it is inherently a fake thing. It is an illusion. It's a glorious illusion. It is one of the most magical illusions possible. But theater is real. Theater is real people in front of you in the same room. They happen to be on the other side of this magic wall that puts them into costume and light, but they are real people in real time directly in front of you. And that's there's nothing else like that.
Let me ask you, because everything you're saying, I know at least three people in here, because one of them is a stage manager, but we're trying to get her on stage eventually.
It'll never happen.
I adore the audience being a part of the production. It makes it better. And I'm just asking Ian, the actor now. Have you ever been on the stage and, you know, in the middle of something and someone says something or does something that makes you kind of break?
Yeah, so it's not so much breaking, but there's a moment of trying to keep in. I did so two moments that were great. I was doing Twelfth Night, one of my favorite Shakespeare plays, years and years ago, and we're doing it, and it's burning cold, so the audience is right up on you, right? I mean, it's very close. It's the perfect space for Shakespeare, because in Shakespeare you really are supposed to be basically on top of the audience. That's how that's That's how the theater he wrote his plays for was built. That's how he expected them. And there's a lot of moments that just don't work unless you are in this very close proximity with the audience. as we are there. The problem is modern audiences don't get that. And so they do their own thing. We all have had the people on their phones in the audience. That's one thing. We had a guy front row who had a copy of the script and was reading along as we were going.
Oh my gosh.
And we were all like, what? And there comes a moment. I think it was Fessy. I think it was Yolanda Rabin who did this. It could have been one of the other clowns in the moment who literally just took it right out of his hand, took it out of and threw it right over the shoulder. Because it's like, because that was what the character would do. That's what Fest. I don't know if it was her or if it was Sir Andrew. It was one of the three in that mm-hmm. in that scene, mm-hmm. Because they're clowns, right? Mm-hmm. And the clowns in Shakespeare, especially, get to leave the reality of the play. And certainly, if that character or that person is there, because the great thing about acting, you know this, is that if something happens on stage, it has happened in the world of the play. I had mm-hmm. students who asked me, what happens if I sneeze? It's like, you don't imagine the character has never sneezed, mm-hmm. right? The character, if you sneeze, the character has sneezed within the reality of this world. And because the clowns in Shakespeare get to be aware of the reality of the audience as well. You know, if Festy is like, why? What are you reading? Give that to me. Get that out of here. That was the same show that one of the other clowns, Sir Toby Belch, one of the gels in the lights fell out in the middle of the scene. And it was great. It was flowing down. And he just stopped and he watched it go down. And he picked it up and he looked through it and he folded it up, put it into his coat pocket, continued on. and that's the thing is that if it happens, it happens. Mm-hmm. And if you can take that in as a person and then put it back out in the world as the character, then you've just enriched the play. It's not a distraction. It's mm-hmm. it's part of the world. There is John Gulley, the great, great theater teacher. Yeah, yeah.
UNCG. Mm-hmm. Yep. Spartans.
I've learned so much from him. The saying he had, which he got from Meisner, is "What you're doing is what you're doing," right? And it will be on my tombstone. And that idea that, you know, if you're on stage and something happens, respond to it. Because to not respond to it, to not do the thing, is to inherently be false. It is to be fake, because if it happened in reality, we would do it. So just do that. Respond as you would respond, ideally through the lens of the character, but certainly don't respond because you haven't thought out in advance how the character would respond. The response is the important thing.
So I've been doing theater for almost 20 years. And why did you look at me like that? I've been doing theater for almost 20 years, and I feel like in this time frame, I knew nothing about theater because you have just taught me so much. Yeah. I know nothing. Let me go back to square one.
Well, it's because I'm here because I wrote a play, because I write plays, and I act because I love to act. But that's none of the things where I am. And my day job is I'm a software developer, but that's not what I am.
Just throw that in there.
I'm a teacher. Is that right. The fundamental truth of who is Ian Finley, in one word, I'm a teacher. It's what God put me here to do. I believe in the idea of a vocation, right? The trouble is, in the state of North Carolina, which I love very much, to be a public school teacher is not to be well compensated, right? That is a simple truth of the matter here. There's much that is good about it. We have wonderful schools. I have taught with the best people in the world in North Carolina. But, you know, it is not a way to make a, what's the saying? It's you can make a killing, but not a living, right? So, So I left teaching a couple of years ago to go into software development because that is something I could do from home and have the flexibility to do theater again. Mm-hmm. When I was teaching theater, I was unable to act for 7 years. So I was just, once I was able to get back into software development, which I did way back in college, I now have time to act and to do shows and to write plays, which you can't really do when you're teaching. But fundamentally, I am a teacher, you do that for 20 years, and you just pick up some idea. If you're teaching theater for 20 years, you get some ideas about how theater works.
Right, right. So I do want to ask you this as we start to wrap up here. What is your favorite part of Native?
It's the actors. We have two ideal actors for this. David came to me because he initially was like, this is a story, and Paul Green is a person I have a great deal of affinity for, and I would like to try my hand at being Paul Green on stage. So he came to me initially knowing that Paul Green was someone that he wanted to do and could bring passion to, and he, of course, he's perfect for that part. And then we spent years finding Richard Wright.
Really?
We spent lots of different people for different readings, as we said, and just as the script itself needed to develop, we needed to find the right Richard Wright. We looked at lots of different people, and then Josh came in and read, and it's like, oh, well, good, finally, that's done. We found Richard Wright. Because there has to be...
No pressure.
Right?
With Richard, this two things that have to be in tension against one another. And right. One of them is the depth of passion, and the other is the depth of intellect. And Josh has that. And so seeing that together is my favorite part of the whole thing. Being able to see these two very, very fine performers bring words that were just words in a book or words from an essay or words from a letter, in Paul Green's case, suddenly become words actually in the mouths of living people in argument with one another.
Well, I have to admit that I didn't know who Richard Wright was until I got this script. So You made me want to learn who he was. So before we go, I want to ask you, though, what are your upcoming projects? Because I know that all the work that you're doing, you have to have something else coming up.
Yes.
What are those projects?
So I have, I'm very, very excited and very, very overwhelmed. I will be playing Werner Heisenberg in Copenhagen, Burning Coal coming out in October. So that is my acting thing. That is the one piece of acting I'll be doing this year, because it's... it turns out rehearsing a play takes a lot of time, a lot of energy. I did two of them. Last year, which I absolutely loved, but oh my word, that's a lot of hours. So It's like, okay, I want to do one show this year, and then I was offered literally one of the dream roles of my life to play this. So it's like, that is more than worth the hours to do that. And then starting writing on another piece that David and Serena actually approached me about, and this is another... another real person in this case, and so I'm now starting the what will probably be another year of reading to try to get his voice figured out as well. So that's much further on the horizon, It is now on the horizon.
Awesome.
So first, I want to thank you for joining us today. And if anyone listening wants to meet you, you will be at the Native performances, which run September 13th through the 22nd, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And there's also talkbacks on the 15th and the 22nd, and You'll be there. So if anyone wants to meet you and get some more of that wonderful knowledge, they can definitely come and see you and see the man behind the words, the creation.
Behind the veil.
But yes.
Behind the curtain.
Yes.
So thank you so much for joining us today and educating us. That's what I'm feeling.
Yeah, I am empowered and enlightened and all of that stuff.
Awesome.
Thank you so much, Ian.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. I hope you enjoyed playing with us today.
Yes.
Okay, we're going to work on that. We're gonna
it's not a bad thing.
Yeah, I don't know how I feel.
Let your inner child out. Your inner child.
Your child's still in the same magic booth.
Yeah, right. Right.
Thank you for listening to Artistry Avenue, the intersection of theater and social issues. Artistry Avenue is a Reclaiming Our Time production. To learn more about Reclaiming Our Time, visit www.reclaimingourtime.org. That's reclaimingourtime.org. If you would like to share your stories or give us feedback, you can email us at reclaimingourtimethepodcast@gmail.com or call us at 984-401-0616. We look forward to hearing from you. Our inaugural theater production, Native, written by Ian Finley, runs September 13th through the 22nd, 2024, at the North Raleigh Arts and Creative Theater in Raleigh, North Carolina. Tickets are now available for purchase at www.reclaimingourtime.org/current.